Hello and welcome to Irreverent Testimony, brought to you by Netroots Radio, the political podcast by and for millennial and Gen Xer types from a left-wing perspective. It is November 10th, 2016. We are 3 days into Biff Tannen's America and still standing. We have a very special guest with us. Of course, I'm Travis. Rachel has just sat down to join us.
Hey, everybody.
And a very special guest, my good friend and fellow musician, Gwen. We'll just go by Gwen, or?
Yeah, let's just go with Gwen for now. I don't want to get all fancy.
All right. Gwen, who's a very dear friend of mine and the guitarist in my band, who I guess I can start talking about now.
Please do.
Also an amazing guitar player that I'm very privileged to be in a band with, a band called Married a Dead Man.
Yes.
We're playing tomorrow night in Denver at Tennyson's Tap, and on the 17th at the High Dive, and a benefit for Girls Rock Denver, which is a summer camp where young girls are taught to how to play instruments and write songs and all kinds of cool stuff. So
By women. And then they do a little concert afterward.
Yeah.
And they play the song, and it's the most delightful thing I've ever seen in my life.
So this is a fundraiser, right? Is that what this is at the High Dive?
This is.
Okay. Because I'm not part of Girls Rock Denver because no boys allowed, but I'm playing the show.
Well, you're supportive.
I am.
Yeah, you're allowed to support them.
With my all-girl band.
And your money.
Yeah.
So, and everyone should be encouraged to look up and support financially and in any other way that you can. Girls Rock. They are a nationwide organization. Is that right? As far as you know, Gwen?
Well, here's the thing. I'm not part of it either. So I may not be the person to ask.
Okay.
Yeah,
so I think it is.
It's my Jamie and Megan.
Yeah. So Jamie, who is the drummer of Travis's band, Married a Dead Man, again, playing on Friday at Tennyson's Tap, was a member of it last summer, and she is a drummer, and she taught little girls how to play drums.
Yeah.
And we went and saw them, and they played at the Oriental, which is a pretty big theater in Denver. And it was like a joygasm. It was just like the most lovely thing I've ever seen in my life. I couldn't possibly endorse it more.
It was fun. I even had fun. And my friend Jeremiah, who you've heard on play music on the show before, was there, and he had a good time. And so my friend Gwen, who is joining us, is a trans lady. And we're going to get into that in the second half and some trans issues. But yeah, Biff Tannen's America. You know, it was last year that it was the 20-year anniversary of Back to the Future Part 2, right? And people were talking about how much crap actually was accurate or came true. I didn't think that part was going to come true, guys. How the fuck did we get here?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And unfortunately, it did not involve a time machine getting us a bully.
No, it didn't. It didn't involve a sports almanac from the future. It involved a plot device much, much dumber, that being the American voting public. But before we get into that, let's talk about some, I know it's hard to imagine, but some good things.
Can we,
that happened Tuesday? Let's talk about a little bit of that first.
Okay.
Well, I was specifically going to talk
about Donald Trump.
We'll get to him.
President-elect Donald Trump.
Don't give him a title. Call him asshole if you're going to call him
something.
He
already has it. That's
well,
that's the stage of grief I'm going through.
Okay. But before we do that, let's talk about a couple of silver linings before we climb onto the black cloud and ride it into the future.
Okay.
HB2 could be gone soon in North Carolina because Pat McCrory lost.
Yes.
And that's a big one.
Yeah.
Not that similar bills won't pop up now other places, but this was sort of the big,
the
symbolic,
sort of like big first state initiative that passed and that was signed into law that caused a national uproar.
Yes.
In Indiana.
Caused a lot of companies and big organizations.
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, in North Carolina, I think you mean. I think you said Indiana.
I'm sorry. You're right. North Carolina. Yes.
Indiana had their own they were trying to do. But
yes, you're right. It was. Yeah.
And, McCrory actually lost one of the few good pieces
that does
of
not
news.
Make HB2, you know.
Well, no, but the new governor is likely to scrap it.
And I don't know. I think that's a good sign. I know that, you know, in a place like North Carolina, you had a lot of business interests coming into that.
Yes.
And, you know, you can make the human rights arguments, and those really are important. But one thing that does, honestly, unfortunately, persuade a lot of people is money.
Yeah.
Is business.
That's exactly right.
And I think, I know that in Georgia, they were trying to get through some really restrictive legislation, and it was threats by business that did that. And hopefully, at least, this sends a message that, look, if you're going to try to be this bigoted, if you're going to try to be this terrible, you know, recognize that, like, it's not just going to be that, you know, you're depriving these people of their civil rights, because apparently that isn't the issue, but it's also going to be that you're kind of tanking the welfare for your whole state. And hopefully this, I don't know, hopefully that sets a good precedent that says, no, this kind of legislation, if you push this through, the voters are going to react. The businesses right. are going to react right. and people will push back.
And I want to specify here that we're not talking about mom, dad, Joe Blow business. We're talking about major corporations who do business in these states.
The NCAA.
So we're not talking about the bigoted Google. Piece of shit, sweet sugar cake, whatever thing in Denver who yeah. wouldn't make wedding cakes for. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about.
Make those penis cakes, Grandma.
Right. Well, and I'm going to get to that in a second. We're talking about major corporations who have headquarters in these states, and they fear for the safety of their employees and their employees'
yes.
families.
Yes.
And they refuse to allow their business to be done in those states for fear that their employees might be at risk of litigation or persecution or oppression. And so they are saying, we're not going to do business in this state anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like, you know, the corner store downtown's mad about HB2. It's like major corporations with huge moneyed interest.
Yes.
Large job making opportunities in these
yeah,
states.
And they
are
lost
saying,
a lot of jobs.
I'm done.
Because
we're
of
not
this.
Doing this. And yeah. that's what's making the biggest difference. And I'm with you. The civil rights should be the most important thing. But I think that because we live in the capitalist society that we live in, the fact that some of these major corporations are coming out and saying, we're for those rights, and therefore we are going to use the power that we have, which is our money, to take our power out of your state, is something that's a little bit revolutionary and new in terms of a corporation caring more about the civil rights of their employees than their profit margin.
Well, and it is just a good sign, you know.
Yeah.
It's a sign that this incredibly regressive legislation, you know, that they're is a way to fight back, and there's a large segment of society that will say no.
Right.
No, and again, like you said, I'd love if it was about the civil rights, but the thing is, you whatever gets the rights through, that's, as a trans person, that's what I care about.
Right.
At the end of the day, the acceptance is really important, and the respect is really important.
Right.
But I'd rather, what I want to see is some trans person in like rally or,
yeah.
you know, rural North Carolina or something like that, can't get fired for being trans.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly.
And I think going back against what I just said about money is that the reason that those big companies did that is social pressure. Mm-hmm. And that social pressure comes from trans communities and trans allies saying, we do not accept this. And if you do this, we're going to boycott you, or we're going to impact you financially.
Well, let's hold on. Let's hold on to that theme.
Yeah.
Of social pressure.
Yeah.
And bring it back up at certain points in the night on this podcast, because what we're going to try to do, besides lamenting and doing an autopsy on this fucking disaster that took place Tuesday, is also talk about what we can do, because we're not helpless. We are not hopeless. There's a lot we can do, and there's a lot we must do, and there's a lot we will do. And we're going to talk to you over these next weeks and months and years in our bunker here that we're hiding from the stormtroopers or whatever the hell else we have to do, to tell you how to resist and how to refuse and how to.
And I'm going to be totally honest. Travis is going to be a little more hopeful and not hopeful, but just, you know, optimistic and
well, I don't even know if it's optimistic. It's pragmatic.
Yeah.
If you want to call it survival, or if you want to call it organization.
I'm just in a different stage of grief than you are.
That's entirely possible.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about all of that.
Okay.
And more.
Okay.
On this wonderful program. that some people wondered, will it continue? Yes, it will continue into perpetuity.
Of course it will.
So there's that, but a couple other slight pieces of good news before we get to how the Death Star has been built and is targeting us. Marijuana laws passed.
Yes,
in a bunch
I was
going to
bring that up too. Yeah, every state that it was run in.
Which were? Do you want to go down the list?
I don't have it in front of me.
Well, I know California was the big one,
which is huge. I mean that.
Yes,
you know that's legalized recreational marijuana in a state of like what is it, 54 million people?
Yeah. The LA douchebags can stop fucking visiting us now.
You no, know they're not going to stop.
Okay.
You
know no, of course not. Because they can like snowboard while high and run into a tree.
Right, right.
but.
Just kidding. We love all the tourists.
We do. That's the one thing that. Yeah. Obviously, the anti-prohibition cannabis crowd is really excited that I think it was 5 and it might have been 6. There's a recount in Maine about recreational marijuana. So we're not even talking medical at this point. We're talking about recreational.
Right.
And it passed in every single state, and except there may be a recount in Maine. And I don't have those states in front of me. I'm sorry. But it was an overwhelming majority of the voters who had it in front of them saying yes. There wasn't a state that said, no. And so when we talk about the sort of laboratory of states, the states being a laboratory for democracy, I think that Colorado and Washington, and I know that Washington feels like the ugly stepsister of Colorado about pot because we passed it at the same time, but we implemented ours first. So Colorado has sort of become the pot state, and Washington laments that. But I think that the laboratory that was Washington and Colorado proved to maybe even people who don't smoke pot or maybe are a little more conservative, the tax revenue and benefit of having recreational marijuana, and that we don't need to go down the you know, medical, then recreational path.
Right,
the same way that sort of we did with gay marriage, right?
Right.
Like a lot of the states started
unions,
with civil unions and then we worked our way toward gay marriage and then it sort of became a landslide. I think that we're seeing the same pattern of we don't need to start with these baby steps because the world might end and everyone's going to be a pot smoking gang member or something. Like we just, it's just like alcohol. And I think Colorado and Washington proved that. And I think that that shows itself in the polls.
Okay. And maybe sort of the last piece of good news, now that that campaign you worked on is over.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about it?
I do. So you guys might remember back in the day, there was this vile woman in Colorado named Joanne Windholtz.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a shooting at Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood. Three people were killed, two mothers and one off-duty police officer, by a man who attacked the facility because he was a pro-lifer and he thought that the doctors and the people that were there were baby killers, etc. And the state representative in Colorado in House District 30, Joanne Windholtz, came out and said that violence begets violence, and until Planned Parenthood stops violence against its inside of its walls, it should expect violence, and basically advocated for the murder of these people because she was pro-life. So we went on a campaign online and social media to expose that, and we were very successful. This podcast and also an online Facebook group. We went to the Capitol and delivered 60,000 signatures to Joanne Windholtz to resign. She did not do that. The Republican Party in Colorado continued to support her. She was not primaried. And so I went to work on the campaign of the person opposing Joanne Windholtz. Her name was Daphna Michelson-Janay. You guys have heard her twice on our podcast, once before the primary was over and once she had won it. She won in this crazy, 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 insane campaign of nonsense where everyone that I love lost. Daphna won. She won by a little over 800 votes. Joanne Windholtz had won by 106 previously in a midterm election year.
Oh my God.
In this 30-30-30 county, which means 30% Republican, 30% Democrat, and 30% Independent, she won by a little over 800 votes.
And how many doors would you say you knocked in
your time? I would say, oh God, probably 10,000.
So it made a difference.
But I wasn't the person that won this. I would like to give credit to her campaign manager, which was Kim.
Well, and you had something to do with it. That's the point.
I did. I did the very best I could for as long as I could. But her campaign manager and the help of our volunteers and supporters, the help of Planned Parenthood Votes Colorado, which mm-hmm. is the political arm of Planned Parenthood in Colorado. I'd like to give a shout out to Ashley Wieland, who just is a tremendous human, and I grieve for Hillary's loss for her, I think, more than almost anybody else, because she was just the biggest fan. But her group, her organization, phone banked and canvassed and knocked doors and just got the vote out. And before getting out the vote, because there's two different sort of stages in canvassing. One is what we call persuasion, mm-hmm. which is where you go to people's doors and you say, "Hi, I'm here. This is my candidate. I want to tell you about them and why my candidate's better than your candidate. And please vote for mine instead of this other one. And here's why she's good and that person's bad." That lasts until, at least in Colorado, until the ballots are dropped. Mm-hmm. And what that means is in Colorado, we have a mail-in system. So ballots are sent out October 16th, and most people receive them October 17th or 18th. And at that point, there really is no more persuasion, because most people are going to know who they're going to vote for or not. So at that point, the strategy changes and it becomes get out the vote. It becomes right. Just go to every Democrat's door and make sure they fill out that ballot. Each volunteer is allowed to take 10 ballots and drop them off at a drop box, no more than 10. And so the effort really became as many people as you can to get to as many Democrats as you can, or likely Democrats or strong Democrats, or just anyone that you think might vote your way, and ask them to fill their ballots out and ask if you can drop them off. And we just had an incredible surge of people during that process, and it won by 800, a little over 800 votes. So in a bright spot in the world, we have a pro-choice, pro-woman, pro-minority, pro-LGBT, pro-everything candidate that mm-hmm. will be replacing the garbage human that previously occupied that seat in our state
let's pivot a little bit to state politics now, since we're Coloradans.
Sure.
Unfortunately, we did not take back the state Senate, but we expanded the Democratic margin in the state House.
Yeah.
So
we already held the House.
This stuff is more and more important now
than
ever.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough loss. I understand not as tough as everything else, but we really only held we're missing the state Senate by 3 seats. Mm-hmm. And the one race that you and I were most focused on was Morgan Carroll, mm-hmm. and she lost.
Yeah.
Which sucks.
The Republican RNC poured a shit ton of money into that race.
They did. $8 million versus our $5 million.
Yeah. Well, I was still talking about the state.
Oh, the
Senate and Senate. House.
Yes. Okay. So, yeah.
We didn't take it back, but we expanded the
House,
the Democratic,
and we did not
House.
Have a governor up for election this cycle.
Right,
so
but
we
this
still
is why I'm saying this stuff is really, really important. If you're in a state that has at least one, hopefully two branches of the state government controlled by Democrats, there's some buffer mm-hmm. to the shitstorm that's coming.
And we are lucky that in Colorado, we're semi-blue.
Yeah.
Mostly blue.
Yeah.
And there's autonomous sources of money.
Yes.
Like oil, which gets into a whole
oil
weird
and gas.
Area.
Yep.
Oil and
absolutely.
Gas.
Absolutely. Which is good a controlling economy. Factor in our economy and in our political government, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. There were some really interesting returns here. I don't want to get into the local stuff. Like, we continue to fund art, which is actually a thing I think people don't know that much about Denver and Colorado, mm-hmm. but we're pretty proud of our arts and culture. Mm-hmm. And we overwhelmingly won the continuation. There was an arts funding program that was sunsetted that is a tiny, tiny amount, like 0.45 cents on every $10 that you spend mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. that allows us to have the Denver Zoo and the Denver Arts Museum and the Denver Nature Museum and Science and all of the, we have great public art in our city. Mm-hmm. That was continued. The cigarette tax was overwhelmingly said no it was like 70-30 cigarette tax because the tobacco lobby came in, and I saw zero yes on 72s, and I saw,
tons of commercials against it.
Commercials, yeah. Flyers, mailers.
Gwen has an interesting take on that, sort of similar to Dana's.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, it wasn't specifically about the cigarettes, but the argument can be made, I don't know, has been made. Again, this came from me, from someone trying to introduce a soda tax. This is
sure.
In Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Place very poor. You're
yes.
talking North Philadelphia.
Yes.
You've got $10,000 median family income in some areas. When you think about something like a soda tax or additionally a cigarette tax, who are the people who are drinking soda? Who are the people who are smoking cigarettes?
Right.
Well, there are certainly wealthy people doing it. It's more poor people.
It disproportionately impacts the poor.
Right. And yeah. That's Dana's argument.
It is Dana's argument. Yeah. Also, he's a cigarette smoker. But so am I. But I voted for it. But I agree with you and him and this one, that it's an addictive drug.
Yeah.
That it's that I've been really poor and a smoker. And I have been in that situation where my last $5 does go to a pack of cigarettes and not necessarily something else.
Yeah.
So I do feel and hear that that is true, that it does disproportionately affect poor people.
Colorado.
Is it also effective at preventing smoking, though?
And the yes, it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a public health guy, I can tell you.
Yeah, it
yes.
is. It really does work. So I have like this tension inside of me that.
Well,
once,
maybe it's not fair to compare soda taxes and cigarette taxes.
Well, but you, in some sense, and this will probably tie into the discussion we're about to have. So let's say that you are somebody who's poor. Let's say that you're disenfranchised. You don't feel too connected to the government. You make like $15,000 a year among
yeah.
your family, and you're a smoker. And somebody decides to raise the cigarette tax on you. Now, it probably wouldn't affect them. It wouldn't affect a lot of any of the rich folks in town. If they did smoke, they could still afford it. No
yeah.
biggie. But for you, this is a thing where these people who are basically unaffected by it are kind of telling you, here's what you do with your body.
Right. Now, now here's
hold
the
on.
Thing.
I want to, can you hold on for a
yeah,
minute?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So they're telling you it's social engineering, right? It's saying, I know what's best for you. And so I'm going to make it more expensive for you to do what you want to do with your own body.
Libertarian yeah. argument.
And you, well, here's
well,
the thing.
I'm not saying it's a bad one. I'm just saying it is a libertarian argument.
Yeah, but I agree with that.
That's well, okay. I'm just saying that if our friend Raul was here, he would give you a big thumbs up.
Well, and here's the thing, you have to think about that. Let's say you are somebody like that, or you're in West Virginia, for example, and somebody passes that law. You're already possibly like really disconnected from the government. You might not feel like you have a say. And then somebody tells you, yeah, again, here, we are looking out for your health. You can't do this and you don't have a say in it.
If you do, you have to pay more. You have to pay more than you can afford now.
Well, and in the legislation, you probably didn't feel like you had a say in it anyway.
Right.
And when you think about somebody like that, already disconnected from the government, mm-hmm. where they feel like they've got these elites who are very health
right.
focused, but probably more associated with the liberal side of things, you can see where this resentment would build up towards your liberal elites, towards somebody like that. And you can see somebody, maybe if they get more of that, maybe if, you know, that's combined with all these other
right.
things where people are telling them their way of life isn't okay, you can see where some
or
of the
your
impulses,
perspective, and you can't have your flag anymore too, and you can't have your other things. And,
yeah, and someone in on a
yeah.
coast, some coastal elite is telling you what to do, and then that's kind of a big part of how you get a Trump voter.
That's
profound.
That's the kind of stuff everybody's
that's
talking
no, that's
about
serious.
Right now.
Well, hold on. Like, that's serious, though. Like, as a liberal, and I have myself and my Dana have been impoverished most of our lives, especially growing up. But I didn't ever see it that way because I've somehow always had the idea that it is better to look out for people, you know? But it is infantilizing maybe in some way. And or even if it's not, even if it's, hey, we're just trying to prevent young people from smoking and maybe this will be the thing that prevents it and we'll, you know, fund all these social programs, that is a completely understandable thing that you just said. And
I have to look at it from the other way because I'm a public health guy, master's of public health, and I've been working in public health for most of my adult life. And then I turn around and I look like what you're saying, you get a greedy coastal tobacco lobbyist who's doing the Mr. Burns things with his hands saying, I bet you feel really disconnected from the government, don't you?
Yeah.
Fuck the cigarette tax. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You tell them and vote for my guy. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of competing things here, but the psychology, she's talking about the psychology.
I think that you and I are completely on the same side, Travis, in terms of like why this is a good thing and why it works. And if you look at statistics and public health, we understand
but
that.
But we're fucking up on the messaging.
What Gwen is saying is like, what they're hearing is like
the messaging.
Yeah. Where we lost.
You have to think this is someone who already doesn't feel like they have a say. This is someone who already feels like they're getting enfranchised, and a rule like that doesn't feel like it comes from them.
Right.
It doesn't feel like that's a conversation they were part of.
Right.
And I think that's also in some cases why you see like this really angry backlash against GLBT rights. Obviously, I'm trans.
Yeah.
I am also queer. I don't like to label my sexuality, but you have somebody like that too who maybe is uncomfortable with the idea but maybe also feels excluded from that conversation.
Yeah.
And you can see where again those resentments start building.
Well, thanks for being on the podcast.
That's profound.
These are the types of conversations we need to have.
Yes. And they need to be, and you know, you and I, Travis, have been talking about how difficult this election has been in terms of having nuanced conversation. Everything has been so black and white and so one way or another. And so,
and that we thought it was a winning argument.
Impossible to talk about nuance. And we did. We thought that would be, we were wrong, but we thought that pragmatism and nuance and strategy and intelligence and all of those things would be winning, but they we're not. And
that's the one thing though. So when you say intelligence, that's one of the things I saw so much during this election.
Yeah.
I definitely live in my liberal bubble, but there was all this, the Trump supporters are all stupid. They're idiots. They don't know what's good for them. And that makes a constructive conversation really hard when you think the person you're talking to is stupid and or brainwashed. It makes it hard to listen to them and hard to listen to their concerns. And I think that if there's a lesson I've taken away from this election, it's that that divide is powerful, and our inability, the fact that we've gotten to a point where it's so hard to even have that conversation and to even see these people as people worth having a conversation with. And I'm, you know, it's the same on the other side. That's a huge obstacle.
The problem is, hold on, let me interject for a second here.
Okay, then I'm going to talk first.
That's,
go ahead.
That's fine. The problem is, Gwen, and you're making an absolutely astute, important point, but at the same time, the person who is not stupid and has a reasonable gripe and is attracted to Trump is either happy or willing or just accepting of locking arms with the guy on Twitter who's talking about putting me in an oven.
Yeah.
So there is no simple blanket, let's reach out to these Trump voters and
find out what's wrong with
that. It's that nuance thing again,
and
right?
You know what we just realized is that we're guilty of it too.
Sure. Absolutely. There's plenty of Trump voters who it is worth trying to pick their brains find out where we're wrong. And there's plenty who I don't want to breathe the same air as them.
Yeah.
So
I was going to say, yes, that's true. I think that, I think that we have an empathy gap sometimes on the Republican Party, which we talk about a lot on this podcast, where they don't have empathy for minority groups or like, you know, Nancy Reagan is against stem cell research until her husband needs it. Or mm-hmm. Republicans yep. don't give a shit about sexism until you say something bad about Megyn Kelly. Or
abortion should, or be, abortion should illegal be legal until, their daughter until gets
my
knocked
daughter
up.
Gets knocked up by a rapist. Or there's by, or also, by her boyfriend. Maybe there's an empathy gap among liberals because we don't. I don't think it's an empathy gap as much as it is an arrogance or something. Mm-hmm. So I have a good relationship with my parents, and we talk about my dad a lot on the podcast. And he's a conservative. He is not religious, and I wasn't born with any of those things, but certainly the conservative principles and a lot of the bigoted ones. And he and my mom both voted for Trump, supported him, and in fact went to Trump rallies. And I have had a really hard time squaring who I know my parents to be with who I think of as Trump supporters, mm-hmm. you know, because I know my parents to be loving, thoughtful, decent people. And the thought of them supporting this person that I thought to be, and I still think to be, a wasteland of bigotry and cynicism and violence, was really hard and is really hard for me to square.
Oh, yeah.
But in the way that you were just saying, like talking about all Trump supporters as though they're just stupid and they don't know anything, I don't think of my parents that way.
No.
They're bright, intelligent people. And so I have this gap in my soul that is, how do I square these people who voted for this man who I think fundamentally hates me with my parents?
Well, that's another problem, Rachel, in that there's all kinds of reactions out there, obviously. And I've just sort of been trying to take stock of them and not knee jerk reply to every single one. But I'm hearing a lot. How did we fail in this message that this man is so dangerous and awful and horrible? And the really depressing part of that is that I don't think there's any secret to the fact that Donald Trump is a misogynist and a tax cheat and
a
horrible, loudmouth, asshole, I mean, jerk.
It's all out there. Everyone knows.
People knew and said, okay.
Well, I don't think they just said okay, though. I think that we're going back to this idea of these people lefting out, of people feeling left out of a conversation, of people feeling like they're having things forced on them, people feeling like perhaps they're being condescended by, you know, a coastal liberal lead. I guess primarily coastal. We're not on a coast, but we're,
yeah, we're very landlocked.
I'm from a coast.
I lived on many coasts. Go ahead.
No. So we're kind of coastal.
But yeah, so you've got this situation where they're maybe they feel condescended and all these things. And so all of those attacks on Trump, attacks on, admittedly, thank God the tape thing got through. But the more that you have these big media organizations that these people already distrust attacking Trump, and the more they're kind of tut-tutting him and the more we're shaking our finger at him, I think that one thing that on the left we've kind of done wrong during this election is it's a lot of finger wagging. It's a lot of, oh, no, you shouldn't do this.
Okay, but what is the alternative?
Well, so the thing is, you get all that finger wagging, you get all of that happening, and when Trump bucks that doesn't make him, they're not paying attention to the bigotry anymore. They're paying attention to the fact that he's standing up to the people they already hate.
That's a very good point.
So they feel that they're being finger wagged at, and he's the person who stood up to finger wagging at what they believe in.
Yeah. Cause you have to think like, okay, the Amish supported Trump a lot.
What?
Yeah. No, the Amish were huge Trump supporters. People tend to think of, you know, people voting for Trump like, oh yeah, they're voting for him because he's like them. That's not true. You know, a lot of Trump voters, if you saw the interviews,
he's from
they're
Queens.
Like, yeah, no, and they're like,
right.
And he's rich and he's an asshole. Right. But, you know, they're you watch interviews with him, they're like, oh no, he didn't mean that. Oh no, I'm ignoring that thing he said. Oh no, he's not actually going to carry out this policy proposal. Trump isn't their exemplar. He is, for a lot of people,
he's their backlash.
No, he's someone fighting for them. He is not a good person. He's not a nice person. He's not somebody you'd want to have teaching your kids. And I think they'd agree with that. But they feel like he'll fight for them. And I don't think a lot of these people have felt like anyone will do that for a while.
And what you mean by fight for them is say, don't wag your finger in my fucking face anymore.
Yeah. No.
Don't dare you. And look, he stood up for the things that I felt finger wagged against my whole life. And I couldn't stand up, but he is doing it publicly and unabashedly, and I want that.
Granted, yeah. It's horseshit, but no, it resonates.
It's horseshit. And, well, the other thing, like, okay, you look at the counties that supported Trump the most. They don't have, like, any immigrants. It's like West Virginia. Every single county in West Virginia voted for Trump.
But why is that?
Well, they're a scapegoat.
Exactly.
And it's also...
The counties that have immigrants... The people that have assimilated with people that are different than them are much more likely to vote for Democrats because they understand that difference is not difference. It's just different.
Well, and
I know that sounds like nonsense, but you know what I mean? Like, if someone looks different than you, that doesn't make them fundamentally other. It just means you have to get to know them and then they become human.
Yeah. Well, and you have to think about this exclusion, though, too, because one thing that some of these people said, they're like, you know, we're out here, we don't have any jobs. And this isn't all the Trump voters, like mm-hmm. Travis mentioned me earlier, you know, a lot of them they're doing fine economically. But there's at least a certain subset of them where they're
the
like,
Rust Belt. Yeah.
Where they're like, you know, we're not, you know, you see the sorry shape the VA is in. You see the horrible circumstances some of these places are in. And they'll say, well, we're taking care of these immigrants before we're taking care of these people. I think that's, again, it's a scapegoat. Trump is blaming these immigrants for, you know, taking what he's telling these people is theirs. And for them, that is apparently resonating.
Well, that's the definition of white entitlement, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's for me, at least. I don't know if you want to get into my feelings are about this yet.
Feelings,
it's a long thing, but.
Gwen, and I wish the talking heads on CNN and MSNBC would talk to Gwen because she's
too.
Making a lot more sense
so
than
much
anybody
more sense.
We watch. But it's important to understand that understanding doesn't necessarily have to mean sympathy or even empathy, but understanding goes a long way to trying to sort out this mess.
Well, I think, yeah, I do. And I think that, I think you're right. Like, understanding a more subtle and, again, nuanced version of this white entitlement is helping me. Does not mean that it is a good thing or that Trump, that should resonate. But then, you know, yeah.
Well, there's a lot we have to sort out, right? Like one of the factors is when you crunch the raw numbers and where it really mattered in these really important, crucial states is where things got real fucked up. But when you break down the numbers, the total number of Trump votes was fairly equal to what Romney got and actually less than McCain got. Mm-hmm. The problem is the total number of votes Hillary got was below what Obama got both times. So that could be a couple things. You could have had a lot of people who voted for Obama switched over, which some of them probably did. And the fact that a lot of people who would typically vote Democratic just either were fed the narrative that both these candidates suck and they're both the same, or they just were not excited enough. And we would have hoped.
I have one other alternative.
Well, hold on.
Is that there was no way he was going to win. So why even bother voting? Because Hillary's going to win. I don't need to go to the polls. No, I really do
maybe
think that's part of it.
Maybe some of that, but you know, the last couple of weeks between the Comey thing and the polls showing a 2 or 3 point race, there might have been some of that, but not enough.
I think a lot of people were like, obviously Donald Trump is not going to win. Even those among us have admitted to ourselves in the last 2 days that none of us internalized the possibility that this man could win.
Of course not, which is
and
why we're so
are
devastated.
Political junkies. Imagine if you're
mom...
in Detroit, and you've got two kids, which was a particularly low place of turnout. You've got two kids, and it's busy day, and it's a Tuesday, and you're like, she's going to win. I don't have time. Yeah. I can't go stand in the polls for goddamn 3 hours. I don't have time. Hillary's going to win. It's going to be fine.
And couple that with
that happened.
Well, that happens in every election, though. I feel like if this is a special case, it is like what Travis said, like that narrative of these candidates are equally bad, at least in my bubble, that was everywhere.
Yeah.
That was everywhere.
And your bubble would be 20 something young professional urban.
And a lot of rural people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, 20-something, yeah, just admittedly mostly white, a lot of queer people, a lot of people from up in northern Fort Collins who were poor.
Rachel, you know that area well.
That's my people.
Yeah.
That's my people, yeah.
And in that bubble, I saw a lot of just, they're like, oh, no, these candidates are both awful.
It's not Bernie, it's no one.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's...
I even have some Jill Stein supporters up there. Yeah, I don't think their two made a difference, but fuck you guys.
Well,
yeah, don't get me started on the.
You know, I said almost on Twitter, I think that night, almost sort of hopelessly and sardonically, well, Colorado did our part. She only won Colorado by, I think, less than 2 points, which was shocking. But when you look at everything else that happened, and I don't want to get too much into the numbers and breaking all that down. I'll leave that to Kagro and Greg. They do a really good job of that. I like that we're talking about some more.
Yeah.
Let's get
intense.
Let's peel the layers off here a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I will say that I spared myself and some of my close people, having to stay up late into the night to sort of, it was about by 8 or 9. I kind of,
so Travis has this thing where, which was initially really soothing to me because I was having a near panic attack, before the polls even closed. I was just verklempt. Is that the word?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
Thanks. And,
say it while it's still legal.
You said to me at one point, you said, baby, we're just watching to see how much she wins by.
Mm-hmm.
And
I sure said that.
You were in such a good mood and I was in such a good mood. We have a bottle of champagne that still sits in my refrigerator.
It's going to be there for a while.
Ever. And, I didn't, you know, Travis does a whole thing with like the counties and the polls and the numbers.
Yeah, I do mad scientist thing.
He does this mad scientist thing with his computer where he can tell me what's going to happen. And you were in a really good mood for a couple hours. And then your face started to change and your mood started to change and you started to look at me with this face.
Way before the anchors.
Oh, way before.
It was about 7 o'clock our time.
Yeah.
Well, no, it was earlier than that. It was about six o'clock our time.
It started getting bad at 6 and 6:30, and about 7, I just came and just laid down on the couch and was just like, we can't. And you just were like, I don't know. And then I had to call Dawn, and then it just got worse. My brother Josh called, the famous independent who voted for Hillary, as did his conservative girlfriend.
Yeah, we were wondering about that.
Josh called me because he was at a friend's house getting ready to celebrate that Donald Trump wasn't going to be the president. And he called me and said, I don't understand what's happening and I don't know what to think and I think the news is spinning it. He can't win, right? And then I was crying and he was like, oh no, 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 no. That can't be happening. And I was like, I mean, it's not for sure. This is like 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
Our time, which is 9 o'clock Eastern.
We still didn't know about Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. And
Ohio. And North Carolina. And I said, it's just really not looking good. And he was like, I don't know how to raise my daughter in this country. And it was a whole thing. Anyway, by about 8 o'clock, I think it was like 8:15. It was 8 o'clock our time when you came to me and you said, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. And... you know, I didn't know that people were this awful. And I cried a lot.
It's all a blur.
And then you left at 8:30. And I went to bed shortly after that. And then I went to work.
So this was only 10:30 East Coast time. And the anchors and everybody still.
My new boss was up till 3:30 in the morning our time.
Or pretended to not know what was going on.
Because everyone I knew was up till like 2-3 in the morning waiting for his speech and it can't really be real. I had Facebook posts from my friends that were like, no, if the Cubs can win and the final thing and the thing and maybe there'll be a rain delay and you never know. And people were so hopeful and I'm sort of grateful for you And I'm sure people that know Greg Dworkin have the same feeling is like,
through that.
I'm glad that I knew early and I just my coworkers the same thing.
Well, this is what I'm going to recount it real quick before the break. This is how it went down. I was very, very confident about Florida because there's a great numbers guy in Florida who was looking at all the early number voters and was very confident. It looked really good. And everything was unfolding the way it should because we were looking at the margins in the big cities and that all looked like it should to get about a 2 or 3 point Clinton win. And then the exurb numbers came in. That's the small cities outside of like Tampa and Jacksonville. And, and they were just crushing it for Trump. And he's like, ooh, wait a minute. No, this is actually going to be really close. And I was crunching those numbers and I realized, yeah, I don't think we're going to win Florida. And I wasn't panicked at all because 8 million scenarios were fine. We don't need Florida. That just would have iced it early.
Yep.
Then where the real problem started was Virginia because the polling and the exit polling was showing Hillary +8 in Virginia. And I'm looking at the early returns on Virginia and I'm like, this isn't going to be an 8 point win. I don't even know if this is going to be a win. And that's when it sort of dawned on me, like, if this is happening here, this is happening everywhere. And that's when you said my face at about 7 o'clock, I was like, this is not going the way it should. And literally by 8 o'clock our time, 10 o'clock East Coast time, I knew it was done. And on that note, we're going to take a very quick break and we're going to get into some very specific stuff about trans issues that we've been wanting to talk about for a long time on the show. And then we'll also talk about survival tips.
And also, I'm going to tell you my being a lady opinion about what happened last night or 2 nights ago.
Okay, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. And it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing. Welcome back to Irreverent Testimony. It's me and Rachel and our good friend Gwen joining us tonight. And before we get into some stuff Gwen is going to talk about, Rachel has some stuff for you.
All right. So I've gotten some stuff on Twitter and Facebook from our lovely lady listeners and some stuff from some of my friends. And we haven't addressed the elephant in the room yet, which is that the first woman so close that it was almost we could taste it did not win the presidency. And that has been really hard for us in a way that is palpable. And I think it's been hard for some of the men in our lives everyone was devastated that I know. I don't know any man who voted for Donald Trump other than my dad, and he's old and misguided. All the men in my life voted for Hillary Clinton, and all of them were devastated that Donald Trump won. But there was a special significance to the women in my life that he won, because if she was not enough, the most qualified, reasonable, if she were a man, it would never have been a contest. I think it made all of us feel like, where do we stand? You know, where do we fit in? En masse, women in America were told that we aren't enough to be the best. Hillary Clinton scheduled her acceptance speech underneath a glass ceiling because everyone expected her to win and we could finally break through it. And the fact that that glass ceiling was so intact was, I think, really hard for a lot of us. And it was hard for the men in my life, too. I'm not saying it wasn't, but there was a special kind of demotivation for the women in my life, a special kind of outrage for us that was like, no, you're still not enough. You're still not good enough. Even if you're Hillary Clinton, even if you're the most qualified person to ever run for office, you still lost. So I'm going to read a story from Lindy West that is not going to make me cry, and I'm sorry. But I'm just emotional. This was hard. This was hard. So, Lindy West, if you don't know her, look her up. Follow her on Twitter, because goddamn does she get in the best Twitter battles, and she just never backs down, and she's just trolls them right back. It was in the New York Times, and here's what she said. It's called Her Loss. I got up on election day and burst into tears. Not a genteel twin trickle, but a great heaving burst, zero to fire hose. Tears spattered inside the side of my glasses, dripped from my lips, and left mascara-tinged rosettes blooming black in my cereal milk. Honey, my husband crooned to me. Honey, it's going to be okay. The numbers are still good. It's okay. But it wasn't the numbers. I wasn't sobbing because I was afraid she was going to lose. That would come later. I was sobbing Tuesday morning because as I poured coffee, I'd caught a glimpse of a cable news interview with Mrs. Clinton just after she'd voted for herself in New York. She seemed breathless, exhilarated, a little overwhelmed. Over her shoulder, Bill Clinton stared at his wife and beamed. My husband stares at me sometimes like that. It's not just love. We expect husbands to love their wives, but something less traditional, more conditional and gendered. It's professional respect. It's pride. We're accustomed to that pride flowing the other direction, from the wife to the husband, because men in our culture get to be more than just bodies, to do more than just nurture. Men get to act and excel and climb and aspire and thrive and win and rule and be the audacious, hungry fulcrum of public life. It's normal for men to have ambition. It's normal for women to stand aside. I thought about Bill Clinton meeting Hillary Rodham at Yale in 1971 and how tenacious and intense she must have been back then, how undeniable and potent. Mr. Clinton describes the moment in his memoir, quote, "She conveyed a sense of strength and self-possession I had rarely seen in anyone, man or woman. She was in my face from the start." He says, once he told her during these years, "I have met all the most gifted people in our generation, and you are the best." And then I thought about Mr. Clinton rising steadily through his political career on the track we have built for charismatic, competent white men. He must have known every second how good his wife was. Not just good, but the best. Better than anyone he'd ever met, better than him even. And he watched her stand next to him and wait and wait and wait, underestimated and degraded and excoriated for money more out of life than just cookies. But she didn't quit. She swallowed slander and humiliation and irrational hatred for 3 decades. And she didn't quit. And here she was, just a hair's breadth from the presidency of the United States, the first woman ever to be trusted with the rudder of the world. He must have been so proud of her, I thought. It made me cry. I cried because I want my daughters to feel that blazing pride, that affirmation of their boundless capacity, not from their husbands, but from their world, from the atmosphere, from the inviolable wells of certainty inside themselves. I cried because it's not fair. And I'm so tired. And every woman I know is so tired. I cried because I don't even know what it feels like to be taken seriously. Not fully. Not in that whole, unequivocal, confident way that's native to handshakes between men. I cried because it does things to you to always come second. Whatever your personal opinion of the Clintons, as politicians or as human beings, that dynamic is real. We as a culture do not take women seriously on a profound level. We do not believe women. We do not trust women. We do not even like women. I understand that many men cannot see it, and plenty more do not care. I know that many men will read this and laugh or become defensive or call me hysterical or worse, and that's fine. I'm used to it. It doesn't make me wrong. But maybe this election was the beginning of something new, I thought. Not the death of sexism, but the birth of a world in which women's inferiority isn't a given. That grain of hope glowed inside of me until around dinner time on Tuesday, the final day of an election so openly misogynistic that the question, sexual assault, good or bad, was credulously presented for a debate. Today doesn't feel real. It's indistinguishable from fresh, close grief. But if there's one lesson we can take from Mrs. Clinton, politics aside, and even Donald Trump acknowledged it in the second debate, it's the limitlessness of human endurance. Those of us who have been left in the cold by this apparent affirmation of white supremacist patriarchy, and sorry, white women who voted for Mr. Trump, but your shelter is illusory, are tough. We've been weathering this hurricane wall of doubt and violence for so long, and now more crystalline than ever, we've had an enemy and a mandate. We have this murking apotheosis of our oppression sliming paw first toward our genitals. We have the popular vote. We have proof in exit polls that white women will pawn their humanity for the safety of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. We have abortion pills to stockpile and neighbors to protect and children to teach. We have the right woman to find. We have local elections in a year. The fact that we lost doesn't make us wrong. The fact that they don't believe in us doesn't make us disappear.
Well said, and inspiring, hopefully. And it should also be said that Trump won white women overwhelmingly.
I heard it was 43%.
And what do you mean?
43% of white women voted for Trump. Is the latest that I heard. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it was Republican white women, but I think white women overall.
White women overall voted for Trump.
Oh, my God.
By quite a bit with the last I saw, and I could be wrong about that, but...
The latest I heard was 43% of white women, but I thought that the most important thing from that, in terms of that, was that the difference between white feminism and feminism is that white women can hide behind the patriarchy and still gain entitlement from it, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one more theme I want to get into before we kind of turn it over to Gwen here, and that is I don't want to say it's necessarily a good thing in any sense, but it was an eye-opening thing that for me as a white, cis, straight man.
Yeah.
And you the Venn diagram partially crossing over with us all, at least being white.
Yes. We all have to recognize our privilege where it is.
Yeah. Wherever it is. And I have way more here at this table. Yes. I'll acknowledge. We both said to each other at certain points, Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, wow, they really hate us. And boy, do we feel isolated. Yeah. And then it kind of hit me like, okay, if I was a person of color, you're still thinking, oh yeah, welcome to the party, buddy. You know, 4 centuries of it.
Yes.
And so that kind of shook me out of my privilege for a hot second.
Intersectionalism is really important.
Now more than ever.
And in case anybody out there doesn't know what that means, it just means that it's acknowledging that just being white or just being female or, you know, the patriarchy and the sort of social construct that we live in exists for everybody. Not everybody, but for most people. So, Travis, you are a cis, straight, white dude who makes a pretty good living.
Yeah.
And you're Jewish.
Yeah, ethnically, not religiously, but whatever.
But that doesn't matter.
Oh, certainly not
to the Pepe the Frogs on Twitter who want to burn you in an oven.
No, it doesn't.
At the same time, you don't take that and say, see, I'm just as oppressed as you are.
Of course not.
You understand that intersectionalism means that I am more oppressed than you are.
Yeah.
I understand that as a white, cis woman, queer, I have many more privileges than almost than I can possibly imagine.
Right.
And so I choose to accept that too. Gwen, you are a, go ahead.
Oh, I am a, well, white trans woman, but I've got a college education.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I am in, you know, the professional class. I make a good income.
Right.
I live in a very safe area.
Right.
And I'm also, I pass as a trans woman.
Right.
Which
we're going to get into that. Privilege. Yeah. I wanted to talk about that.
But as a trans woman, the fact that you understand your privilege as being white and, not in poverty, and passing, those are privileges. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I learned that from a trans friend of mine who is not passing and came from a very, very, very lower class situation, and taught a class on intersectionalism and would, you know, go up to the class and say, I am privileged because I am white. And they would look at them and say, how can you possibly be privileged? And they would say, because I'm white. Right? If I was a person of color, I would be in an entirely different situation than I am now. And everything else about them is not privileged. But they understood that that one white thing granted them that privilege. Mm-hmm. So all of us, even not just if you're a straight cis white man, like, look at your privilege and look at how you're treated in the world versus how other people are treated.
Absolutely.
Able-bodied. I mean, there's a million different privileges that you may or may not have.
Well, that's an interesting pivot point because I'm going to kind of turn it over to Gwen.
Yes.
And
me too. I'd love that.
when I met Gwen.
Yes.
When, you know, she talks about how she passed, but meaning that people don't necessarily know she's trans.
Sure.
I had no idea.
Yes.
It was not until Gwen told me. Basically, came up in casual conversation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my reaction was, oh, okay. And then life went on. I didn't really care. It was like, okay, that's interesting.
Except that you cared that her experience might be different from yours.
Sure. But in terms of like the fact that I was going to start a band with her.
How you viewed Gwen in a general sense of a human being. Yes.
Yeah.
Good. I don't know that you get a cookie for that, but it is good.
I'm not asking for a cookie. The point is we're now pivoting to Gwen talking about what that means.
Right.
Versus what that doesn't mean. And I would like you to, Gwen, as much or as little, if at all, to talk about what it was like this journey. Because I find
Or what is it like for you now, or however you want to talk about it. It's totally fine.
Well, let me start because, I first realized I was trans when I was maybe like 10 or 11 years old.
Yeah. Hmm.
Puberty hit and my body started doing all this stuff and it was like, wait, what? I didn't sign up for this. You know, it was weird. It was like, I just didn't see it coming. So the family environment I was in, my parents are old hippies, lovely people, very accepting for the most part, but we lived up in northwestern Colorado, and this area around La Porte. That, you know, a lot of people from outside of the state tend to see Colorado as super liberal, and in some places it is.
Yeah.
We had a white supremacist, straight up Nazi church down the street.
Right. Are you part of, can I ask you, this might be like off the air, but like, there was that weird like community that tried to develop in Northwestern that was like, we're going to make our own, not like
Idaho.
A commune, but it was like a little bit. Okay. No, we'll talk about that.
No, my dad lived on like 5 communes, but no, we just lived in a house.
This is not a commune. I mean that like they tried to develop their own city of like, they tried to rename the streets and try to make it their own city within Fort Collins that was in like Northwest Fort Collins. And they tried to Andersonburg or Andersonville. Were you from Andersonville?
No.
Okay, never mind then.
No, this was LaPorte. This was a separate thing.
Okay. I lived in LaPorte also.
Oh.
Yeah. I went to the elementary school there.
Oh my God. Maybe you went to elementary school with me.
How old are you?
27.
I'm 33, so probably not. Close though.
Unless you were held back severely.
I wasn't.
But at any
rate. Go ahead. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, at any rate though. So, you know, it's, this is, so, you know, I'm discovering these trans feelings and this is around like, would have been around the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And I keep exploring them and it's really tearing me apart because the thing is like, LaPorte's like, you know, you've got Fort Collins there, but for the most part, it's pretty rural.
Very.
And the conception of masculinity there, the dominant one is, it's a cowboy.
Yes.
He is stoic. Yes. He is strong. He is unflappable. He is, you know, he can ride a horse. He can, you can
get a bull.
Yeah. No, he can, he can ride a bull. He can bust a bronco.
Yeah. Yeah. That.
But the thing is, you know, I'm sitting here as a trans person. When, you know, in the early 2000s, you know, all I saw of trans people was documentaries on TLC, like, oh, look at this sad, horrible person disappointing their family. Yeah. So I'm like, okay, well, what I'm feeling can't be that because I don't want to be that.
Sure. Right.
And so I'm trying to fit into this super hyper masculine mode.
Think of Wyoming.
Yeah. No, it was, it was essentially Wyoming.
Yeah.
You know, you go too far. You get into Wyoming and, you know, I had to explain to kids why slavery was not good for black people.
Yes.
That was a real conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, so trying to discover my identity there, and I eventually did come out kind of to my school, you know, just people.
How old
friends.
Were you?
I was 16.
Wow.
And of course, though, I didn't start hormones or anything like that. I was nervous.
Yeah.
And at the time, of course, though, a lot of my friends, well, they were, some of them were queer. This was in the mid-2000s, and trans acceptance wasn't where it is right now. Mm-hmm. The word tranny got thrown out a lot. Oh.
Even by people we really respect, like Dan Savage.
Yeah.
He used to use that term. He does not anymore.
No, thank God. Yeah. I was pissed about it. I hated the guy for a long time.
Yeah.
So it was very weird. And then I finally...
people thought of you... Do you think they thought of you as like a drag queen? Because when I was growing up, and I'm a little bit older than you, we've discovered, people sort of saw transgendered people and drag queens as the same thing. And then there was like a... a little bit of a fight in the community amongst older members and younger members about transsexual and transgendered, and there was sort of that fight. But when you were coming out, was there a fight about, or not a fight within the community, but was there a misnomer about being a drag queen versus being a transgendered person?
There was a misnomer about being a drag queen, about being a she-male, which is a term my mom was really fond of for a while. It was honestly, I had to explain all of it. I had to explain everything. It was just, there was no knowledge.
Yeah.
There was no anything. There was just, no one even could even conceive of it. And I got people asking me all the time, well, were you attracted to guys? And
right.
Okay. That's not related.
Yeah. Okay. So I know this is not like, educate everyone hour, but I do want to say, and you don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, that, sexual orientation is completely separate from gender identity.
Yeah.
So that's something that people have a real hard time with. Mm-hmm. So your sexual orientation is who you are romantically and sexually attracted to. Your gender is completely separate from that.
What you just identify with gender-wise.
Yes. So that's who you are as a gender. So you either male, female, queer, there's a million different genders that you can identify with, but that has nothing to do with your sexual orientation.
Right.
So you can be a trans woman attracted to women or men or both, genderqueer or gender fluid or
asexual.
Yeah. Right. So your gender expression and your sexual orientation have no, they have nothing to do with each other. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Sorry. Trying to remember where I was.
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. So, and this was, I was 16, kind of coming out to people trying to explain this. No one knew what was going on. It was very awkward, but I was happy because I had my friends behind me. You know, I went to one homecoming dressed up and everything like that. But I found out that certain people have a limit, namely my parents. Namely, for my parents, me being trans was too much. Namely, for them, that was not acceptable. That was not a thing. And again, I guess as I kind of go forward with this story and I'll come back to this.
Yeah.
This was in about 2007. And they were not okay with it. But the thing is, nobody really knew what to do with it. Nobody knew what to say. There had been, you know, violence not too long, like a lot of violence at that time.
Yeah.
You didn't have the legal protections that you have now. Honestly, my mother's thought was that I was going to end up as a prostitute who would then wind up getting stabbed and like left in a ditch somewhere.
So this that is when you happen. Fully came out to them and were transitioning that they...
No, I was not transitioning by that
You
point.
Just had told them that this is who you are as a human.
Yes.
Okay.
And then what happened? That was very traumatic. I said, okay, I'm not trans. Fast forward 5 years later, I'm an alcoholic. I'm pretty much ready to end it. I finally decided to actually take the steps to transition. I went to my doctor. I went to a wonderful therapist, Tara Eastcott. She helped me a ton. I went to her and found out that I could get hormones on, you know, just informed consent.
Yeah.
There used to be this thing where you had to live full time as whatever gender you wanted to transition to for, you know, a certain period of time before you got hormones.
Can you talk about how that's different now?
You can just, as long as you understand the medical risks, and most doctors will ask that you've been to therapy. They don't really ask as how much time or anything like that,
right.
But you can just get hormones. And this was a huge issue for trans people and part of what scared me off of transitioning for a very long time because, for trans people, it's much harder if you can't pass in the world. Like, it's not right. Passing privilege sucks. It's not a great thing, but it's an unfortunate truth that non-passing trans people have a much harder time in society.
Yeah. Yes.
And if you can't even take hormones before you're expected to go out into the world, people would refer to it as the gauntlet because, I mean...
Oh, so the barrier before was you have to be passing before you can take hormones or...
No, you had to have a real life experience living as the gender you wanted to identify
as.
What
does that mean?
I would have had to live as Quinn.
Before taking any hormones?
Before any hormones.
That's an act of cruelty.
Well, it used to be worse. Back in the 90s, you weren't allowed to transition if you were... For trans women, you were only allowed to transition if you were attracted to men. And if
the fuck?
No. This next one's going to piss you off so much more.
Oh, my God.
And if the therapist found you attractive.
Wait. Oh, okay. Wait, hold on.
So was that a guideline in the national...
In the DSM-5 or what?
I mean, where did they come up with that?
That was it's the WPATH now, but it used to be like the Harry Benjamin Association for like transgender health or something. But yeah, that was a medical association.
You had to find a therapist who thought that you were attractive.
Yeah.
And then live as a non-passing trans person for a certain amount of time without hormones.
Well, and some people can do that. And
sure.
That was the effect, was that the only people who did wind up transitioning were, you know, these people who could pass really easily. And they were also encouraged to cut off all ties with their friends and family and move to another city.
Why is that mentally healthy?
Because you have to make sure, why would anyone ever want to transition? We can't let people do this.
We can't let them know? Is that the idea? That if your friends and family knew, then that would be psychologically unhealthy for your transition? Or what the... That's insane that you would not need support through this process.
Yeah.
So we just want to cut you off so that no one knows, so that you're starting a new... That's insane.
And this is stuff we never would have known.
And so this is how long ago was this that you had to start over?
Oh, like me personally or like...
No, I'm saying just the DSM.
Oh, that was like back in the 90s. And there's
so we're talking... Okay, folks, we're not talking about the 40s. You know what I mean?
No. Yeah.
This is
Tuskegee
like
trials.
I was alive, like, and trans people were told, your therapist has to find you passing and you have to cut off all of your family and friends before that you can get the medical treatment that you need.
And this is with a community that's, I think we've still got something around a 50% suicide attempt rate.
Yeah.
So, you know, heaven forbid we transition and not kill ourselves.
God damn it.
But luckily the medical community has come around.
Yeah.
Things are easier, which is very good. So I was able to go to my doctor, started my hormone therapy about 3 years ago, and started living as myself a little over 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I can definitely tell you I've been much happier. But
yeah.
Of course.
Has it been, you don't have to tell me or our listeners any of this, but
no.
Has it been easier, harder, or both?
So it's been easier in the sense that, like, I'm not cripplingly depressed.
Yeah.
And that I'm not
suicidal. Or, yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't know. So the way transition gets talked about, sometimes people say, oh, you know, you're doing it to be happy. And that's wrong.
Yeah.
Or you're doing it to be yourself. And that's close, but it's also still not there. It's, I don't know. You can imagine that, it was like there was a picture frame that was crooked my entire life, and then it got turned straight. Or I'd been using a pair of left-handed scissors forever, and I finally got a pair of right-handed scissors. Like, all these things that were just incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Were suddenly
born into the wrong body, basically.
Yeah. No, nothing makes sense, and nothing's intuitive, and you don't know how to
And there's no way to
well, I think what you just said is
understand that
nothing is intuitive, which means that, you know, you were born in a male body and socialized as a boy. And so you were expected to be socialized to those behaviors, and none of that seemed intuitive.
None of it made sense.
None of it made sense. None of it was something that was something that felt natural to you.
No.
And so then there becomes the sort of like homophobia, right? Because you become the queer kid, the gay kid, the like femme kid.
Oh, I wasn't lit.
Okay.
I hid it. I hid from that. Turned into the sexless nerd.
So there's like one or the other, right? Like you either
deny it as much as you can.
Well, and you were in like rural Colorado and Wyoming. And, so you just
a budding teenager, which is hard enough as is.
You know, and we, not to get too much into feminist philosophy, but I'm a big Judith Butler fan, and she talks about gender as a performative act anyway, right? Gender's a performative act. Like, we decide what gender is. We decide what women do and what men do. And so I imagine that as a trans woman in rural Colorado and Wyoming, you were being performative of the male gender as self-protection?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was an act of protection. It was an act of denial. It was an act of, I can't believe that this is me. But none of it was natural.
Right, right.
You know, none of it was, I didn't want to. You know,
that has to be exhausting.
Oh, no, that's the thing. You don't have energy for anything. And the thing is, you're shutting out this part of yourself, right? This huge part of yourself. This, you're shutting out a lot of your passions. Like, I love clothes. I love fashion. Things like that. And that couldn't be expressed. And you're holding all these things in, and the thing is, that's not all that you're holding in. You can't hold all that in and let other good parts of your personality out. So I was withdrawn, and I was very just distant. It was like I felt everything from outside, you know, from behind a wall or something like that,
right?
And it was all just incredibly muffled.
So what was the turning point, or what happened after that?
Oh, then, do you mean after my transition?
Well, I just mean like sort of after, like when you decided to transition and what?
Oh, what was the thing that made me do it?
Yeah.
Made me decide?
Yeah.
Really a serious depression. I'd tried to fight it for an incredibly long time, but, there was a year where I spent a month inside my house drunk, and then I lived in a living room for a year. I was I don't think I was sober for like 3 years for a full day. And eventually it was just, there were a few times where I was just about to kill myself. And I realized that it was either transition or die. And I transitioned.
Yeah.
Those were the stakes.
Well, talk to us a little bit about what you're doing for other people in the process of transition, because I know you've been doing some work to help them find their way, basically, right?
Yeah. So what I've been trying to do, transitioning is interesting because it's not just, you know, finding yourself and things like that. It's also, you know, you've been socialized into one particular role for a very long time. And you basically have to learn for a trans woman, you have to learn to be a woman. For a trans man, you have to learn to be a man. You have to learn all these lessons that everyone else has been taught forever and ever. So, yes. You know, I remember my struggles, like figuring out, oh my God, what clothes look good on me? Because that actually was a big issue.
Yeah.
And my voice.
Yeah. You mentioned before you had to relearn to talk. I've worked in neuroscience and with stroke patients. And I was thinking like, yeah, that's a thing that stroke patients do. They relearn to walk and talk in some cases. So it's hard for me to even conceive of. And it's something I literally didn't think about before you mentioned it.
Yeah.
That just the act of speaking as a woman and not the timbre of your voice or anything else, it's a totally different thing, right?
Yeah. It's not just the tone.
I want to hear Gwen kind of explain it.
Yeah, because it's your voice in your head. It's having to make it a little breathier. It's emphasizing your words with tone rather than with volume and things like that. And these are things, it's like learning a new language.
Right.
Except, you know, you're in a country where they only speak that language.
Right. So your accent's not going to get away with it, right? It's not like you can fuck up and someone will go, oh, what a cute accent.
No, you'll fuck up and someone's going to go, oh.
Oh.
And you're going to be outed.
Right.
Which is all out myself all the time, but it really sucks to not have any control over it. So what I've done is there are some of my friends, they know trans women or people who are thinking about transitioning, and they've said, they've connected these people with me, and I've just done what I can to help them. I've given them
Are you doing voice coaching or resources? No, nowhere near that good.
This is all on a very personal level. It's more like bringing them to support groups, which unfortunately is the only place that trans people really congregate. I have my own issues with that. And just being someone to talk to, because that's the first thing when you're transitioning is you have spent your entire life basically thinking you're crazy and thinking there's something wrong with you. And that's another hard thing. You know, there's the voice, there's the clothes, and then there's realizing you're not a monster.
Yeah, you're not.
No, I'm fucking fantastic.
I fucking agree with that 100%. I do want to ask you one question. And I don't want you to take offense, but I do want to ask you. Coming from a place, and I don't know that you ever fully experienced male privilege because of the fact that you were always trans and were always trying to hide the fact that you were trans. But I've talked to some trans men who have transitioned, and they've talked about the difference of privilege between being a woman or being a dyke woman or being a gay woman or whatever, and then transitioning into becoming a man.
Yeah.
And how that passage of privilege has really impacted their lives. And I wanted to ask you if you had any thoughts about that, because I find it, I don't think that anyone other than trans people can properly talk about the passage of privilege unless they ever experienced both. And I don't know that you have, so I just wondered.
Yeah, no, I absolutely have. Like, so before I transitioned, my voice was really deep. Like, it was like, yeah, like the defining feature of me, like me in general. So I had a lot of like authority, and people, even though I was not very, I didn't think I was intimidating, people would get intimidated by me. So no one ever like messed with me, I guess. Yeah. I didn't like, no one on the street would like hassle me or anything like that. Now I'm living in a city, living near Colfax Avenue in Denver, which if you know Denver is it's seedy. It's getting better, but it's seedy. And one of the first things I noticed was just, you know, as a guy, I got used to walking around in feeling like at least relatively safe.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, I'm getting like catcalled and
right.
I'm getting,
right.
you know, all these stares. And suddenly I realized that, and my girlfriend pointed this out to me later, that there are certain blocks I don't go down. And she's tough as nails.
Yeah.
And yeah, so nobody screws with her.
Yeah.
But I realized that there are certain places I don't go.
Anymore.
Yeah. No, geographically. Like, yeah. I didn't realize that was something privileged, that simply being able to actually physically be in certain places
yeah.
is not something that's really as reasonable anymore. I ride public transport and it's a much, certain bus routes I will not go on anymore since transitioning.
Because you're treated differently.
Because people touch my hair. Well,
yeah. And they comment on your body and they can't yeah. call you. And having had some degree of male privilege, although it may have been in a more rural environment.
Yeah.
How does that feel? To have come from, and I'm not asking you to talk about like,
no.
it's better or worse. I just have never experienced male privilege. And it's so interesting to me to talk about people that have experienced both. Well, and what does yeah. that mean?
Well, I want to interject. I want to interject yeah. a quick second, because she's known she's trans and sort of decided she was trans at a very young age. And as a male, I didn't even conceive of male privilege until fairly pretty recently in my life.
No, but
you still
can't understand the other side of that, which is why I'm asking her, because Gwen has experienced what you've said is relative male privilege, right?
But I didn't. It's true, though. I didn't think about male privilege. Yeah. Privilege up until a very...
Of course you didn't.
And the idea didn't sink in until I transitioned.
Exactly right. Right. It doesn't until you don't have it anymore.
Or until you're enlightened and mature enough to...
But you still can't experience it, my love. You can...
I can't experience male privilege? I don't know what you're saying.
I'm sorry. What I'm saying is you can understand that you have it, but you can't experience not having it.
Oh, no. Unless I woke up in the alternate universe under the matriarchy. Like, there's...
right. You can't experience it. That's why it's so interesting to talk to trans people about privilege, because... So my friend Fola experienced mm-hmm. The anti-male privilege.
Right.
Right. So they were identified as female and lesbian and butch, and they just recently transitioned. And... they were talking to me about how the difference was like they have started to pass now and they are
right.
not going by that pronoun yet. But the difference between being a woman and passing as a man, the privilege is astonishing to them. Like
yeah.
Fola was saying, like walking around the world as a butch dyke and walking around the world as a passing man is entirely different. Like, people do not speak to me the same way. People do not look at me the same way. People do not talk to me the same way. The privilege of passing as a straight white man is entirely different than passing as any woman that I ever was. And so that's what we were just talking about, was like, what is that sort of, how does that experience translate? That's all we were saying.
Well, on that note, we are out of time and we're going to have to wrap it up, and we will talk a ton more about surviving Biff Tannen's America, of
yes.
course. Gwen, you have an open invitation to come any old time.
Please come all the time.
Well, since
come back all
since
the
we're
time.
Literally in the same space where the band practices,
yes.
like
yeah.
she's going to be stuck
yeah,
with us, and maybe
true.
We'll just stick a microphone in her face now and then.
No,
of course, just
I'll just make gurgling always. Noises.
Always with consent.
Always with consent. Yeah, but Gwen, please come join us again any old time. We're not going anywhere, and we're going to have a lot
to talk
about.
You know what? We're
going to
be in Biff Tannen's America, and I've already cried for you. I'm done with that. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm still in denial, so.
That's one of the stages.
Yeah, I'm still on that one, though.
Hey, we're here. There's nowhere we can go but forward.
Yeah.
Well, my only closing advice is stay close to the people close to you and the like-minded people who care, and stick together. Don't isolate yourself. That makes it worse if mm-hmm. you can help it.
Yeah.
On that note, stay active, stay tuned, more than ever, stay involved, please, and
we
stay safe
you.
And self-care.
And
folks.
We love you.
Seriously, I mean, Physically, my blood pressure is up. And that's
physically
bad.
I've had 2 panic attacks in 24 hours. Yeah. Legit, not like, oh, I'm having a panic attack. Like,
no, this is seriously
panic attacks in 24 hours. So,
and the election, even if it turned out good, was doing that to people anyway.
Yeah.
Self-care, people.
And just understand that we love you, and like,
we do.
Write us. We'll write you back.
And we
love you.
We will not stop talking as long as they allow us to.
We're not going to be silenced by this orange monster fascist piece of shit.
Nope. And on that note, look us up, Reverent Duo, on Twitter, reverenttestimony@gmail.com. And we'll be back next week. Adios.
Stop.